sun, I say it's all right. It's all right.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines, your national movement building show. And if there's ever been a time when we need both a national movement building show and, more importantly, this growing movement, which is happening in this country, I think we're seeing change in front of our eyes. And Peniel Joseph, great to have you on the show. Well, one of the things that we're going to talk about is the situation in Baltimore, but it's just one continuum. Mumia Abu-Jamal, Emmett Till, Trayvon Martin, Freddie Gray, Michael Brown, it feels like it's moving at an almost escalating rate, not the number of murders, frankly, but the number of consciousness about the murders and the fact that people are finally saying, well, perhaps this is a trend. Perhaps the police themselves are the problem. I've been saying that the only way to cut police brutality by 50% is to cut the police force by 50%. It's inherent in the job. It's inherent in what the police do. And the reason I wanted Peniel Joseph to be on the show, I was thinking of him today, is because he is professor of history at Tufts University. He's also the author of one of my favorite books called Stokely: A Life, which along with Charles Payne, I've Got the Light of Freedom, Clay Carson's In Struggle, SNCC and the Black Awakening in the 1960s, Dan Jorkas and Marvin Serkin's Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, and 5, 6, or 7 others, is on my short list of books that I think you got to read. So, Peniel, nice to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Eric.
So these are, let's talk about the right of protest, the right of black people to protest, and this whole question of, in Baltimore today, once again, the attacks on the efforts to try to avenge, the slander of people in the community, the constant use of the word thugs. The fact there was a great article on The Root today about how the black gangs, the black guerrilla family, the Crips and the Bloods in Baltimore have united to be part of the movement in a very conscious way. And this has, of course, been totally turned on its head as if this is another example of gang violence. What's on your mind right now? What are you thinking about? What are the kind of the political messages that we want to put out to people to get a better grasp of what's happening today?
Yeah, no, definitely, Eric. I mean, I thank you for having me. I think, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates has had great stuff in The Root as well. I wrote something for Newsweek as well. But Coates was talking about nonviolence and how the police should be nonviolent. I think the biggest thing we have to understand is that there is a national and global movement. I think you were talking about that earlier, and that's right on. The bigger issue here is that the criminal justice system and what Michelle Alexander has called the new Jim Crow, that metaphor extends to every single part of American foreign and domestic policy. And so what we're seeing here is that the criminal justice system is a gateway to racial and economic oppression. It always has been, but what the war on drugs has done over the last 30 years is made the numbers tremendous. So we have all these millions of people in prison, parole, probation. We have kids caught up in the juvenile justice system as young as 5, 6, 7 years old. There was a CNN commentator today saying that the Baltimore police, it's just an excuse when they said it was just young people and they didn't want to arrest them. The person said that even if his former FBI guy said that even if the kids were 5 years old, they shouldn't be allowed to do violence. So that's the mentality. When you see black and brown kids getting punished at a different rate than their white counterparts, so they're in the system very, very early. And then there's also the children whose parents are incarcerated, and they're less likely to be on reading level, getting access to good food, good child care, the whole bit. And so when we think about the criminal justice system, what it's turned, you know, we talk about 2.1 million people in jail, black women are the fastest growing population. It's connected to our public schools, it's connected to child care, it's connected to the Clinton crime bill and the welfare reform where you're throwing people out of public housing if they have a joint. All this is interconnected. So when you see a city like Ferguson and see a city like Baltimore, what's going on? The New York Times had an article about 1.5 million black men who are missing from American society because of early death by homicide and also mass incarceration. So whereas whites, it's 99 men to 100 women who are out of jail for blacks, it's 83 men to 100 women. So there's not the marriageable black men out there. In a place like Ferguson, it's 60 to 100. So there's a state of emergency happening nationally. So the governor of Maryland, the mayor of Baltimore, Obama calling people thugs, all this is obscuring what the true state of emergency is. So what's inexcusable is not just the violence, but what's inexcusable is the poverty and the state-sanctioned violence against the people of Baltimore and Ferguson and nationally. That's what's inexcusable. So no one wants to talk about the fact that these structures are decades old. So Obama said it was a slow rolling crisis. Well, it's happened before his watch, but it's happened on his watch as well. So all that's happened with Ferguson last year and Black Lives Matter, and again, Eric, you're a long marcher in this struggle, that those of us who've been marching, and my mom, growing up in New York City, she's a hospital worker, she's retired now, but she was part of 1199. I was on my first picket line in elementary school. So for those of us who remember, you know, 1980 and Ronald Reagan in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and you know, Nancy Reagan said, look at all these beautiful white people in New Hampshire and stuff, this has continued to happen. The positives are this, that more people are having consciousness, but here are the big negatives, and this is when you talk about the black guerrilla family and all these things. The big negative is that our leaders, whether you're talking about white, black, radical, progressive, for the most part, people have not talked about and admitted to the depth and breadth of racial and economic injustice in this country. That's what's going on. So you have young people who, of course, are enraged. You know, Malcolm X said in 1964, black people are angry and I'm the angriest. But Malcolm wasn't enraged because he couldn't articulate the problem. He could. What was enraging was that there was a civil rights leadership that wouldn't acknowledge the depth and breadth of the problem. By the end, King does, but when King and Malcolm are alive, for the most part, King doesn't, even though he knows the depth and breadth. It's only after Watts. King comes from vacation in the Caribbean to Watts. They're yelling and telling him to get out of there, and he sees the depth, and he sees the breadth, and that brings him to Chicago and the eventual break. Stokely always knew because Stokely was in Mississippi. Stokely Carmichael was in Lowndes County, Alabama. He was in Cambridge, Maryland. He was in D.C. and Harlem. So he knew because he had been there. He had slept on the floors of the shotgun shack. So he knew about the layers of oppression. You know, so when you think about what's going on now, there's two generations that have been wiped out because of mass incarceration.
Hold it. Let me just hold you right there. You got a lot of great pieces of the puzzle there. I want to respond to something. This is great history, which is why we have historians, really. If you go back again and listen to the interview that I did first with Pinnell Joseph, who's on our last time he was on the show, but also my interview with Mumia Abu-Jamal, on my conversation with him, we had a long talk in which he gave me the concept of menticide, saying that young black people today have been denied their history. And that's the worst thing of all, is an attack on the mental capacity of young black people, because without a historical perspective, which is why we want historians on the show as well. I want to tell you some good news about something we're doing and then have continue the conversation. We have a campaign in Los Angeles called No Cars in L.A., No Tanks in L.A. First of all, what's interesting is we're trying to put together, and we're focusing on South L.A., in a target area of 900,000 people, about 50%, about 55% Latino and 45% black, first to ask President Obama to cut U.S. emissions by 50% starting now, and to go to the Paris U.N. conference, which is happening in December, which we will be at, to really work on dealing with the clear and present danger of global warming. No tanks in L.A. is attacking the Defense Department's 1033 program, which is giving military weapons-grade weapons to the Los Angeles Police Department, the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, and check this out, Pinnell, the Los Angeles School Police Department. They have 61 M16 rifles that we're demanding, of course, that they return. What's exciting about this is first putting together climate and black liberation and Latino liberation, right? And the second is, I think a lot of people just can't even grasp that the Defense Department is arming these police departments. So in terms of this question of counterinsurgency, the concept of counterinsurgency is very actively being pushed. And I'm interested in any responses you have to this work and any historical thoughts about it.
Yeah, no, I think what this work is really, really important. And certainly, I think part of what we're doing and what we need to be doing is, one, it's really multi-pronged. One prong is just decriminalizing blackness, and that has to do with what you're talking about in terms of, you know, school police having M16s and having riot control military. This is coming from the 1980s and the 1982 and 86 drug acts, but also what Clinton did with the omnibus crime bill.
That's right.
Welfare reform, where they all intermingled social policy and law and order and the criminalization. So crime is black right now. Crime and blackness are mixed right in together. And we've normalized both the killing and murders of black people like Freddie Gray and Walter Scott. But the biggest problem, even bigger, as big as those numbers and those tragedies are, the massive numbers are the numbers of young people who are unemployed and who are caught up in this system, who are behind on child support, who need drug rehabilitation, who need mental health, who need a place to stay, and have none of that, right? And so by the time you have those folks who are still around poor black communities, of course you're going to have CVSs set on fire, right? Because you're going to have certain people who are not connecting in any way to the institutions that are in society and in the community. But the real problem, Eric, is that the number of resources that we've used right now over the last 48 hours, policy-wise and politics, should have been used before there were fires in Baltimore. So the money that's being spent on the National Guard, the money that's being spent on police overtime, the money that's being spent on emergency services right now should have been injected into Baltimore before these catastrophic events, and it should be happening nationally. That's what the president should have said. So when you criminalize rioters and you say that, look, these black rioters are thugs, the thugs are the people on Wall Street and the hedge fund bankers who almost destroyed the nation's economic capacity in 2008, and none of them were prosecuted.
Let me ask you this.
And these are the folks that they will refuse to talk about. But you're going to call the young black kid on the news a thug because he doesn't have any power.
But now, Joseph, let me ask you a question. What's the struggle like among college faculty right now? I mean, I know Tufts very well. I think I told you last time I was almost killed at Tufts trying to integrate a construction union with Chuck Turner and back in the day and say hi to your mom.
Yeah, no,
say
yeah,
hi, and say
yeah,
hi to your mom.
70, yeah.
Right? So the question is, just like Michelle Alexander's great book, which is changing minds. What's it like struggling with, I'm sure, predominantly white faculty at Tufts, unless it became all black since I left, which I don't think it did. What's it like in the classic Boston liberal community where the issue of defending black people's rights, what conversations, let's talk about faculty, because at one point, faculty made some very courageous moves, you know, I mean, on the war, on civil rights, on taking on their own institutions. Tell me a little bit about the mood and some work you may be doing to try to change some minds.
Yeah, no, I think we've done a lot at Tufts vis-a-vis the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. We've done some university-wide events and forums that bring community people in, faculty, students, staff, to talk about everything from Black Lives Matter, Ferguson, voting rights, police brutality, the criminal justice system, the need for a radical restructuring of American social, political, economic policy and politics. I think what's going on now, Eric, is that the more strobe light is cast on all this inequality, especially social media and programs like yours have been very, very crucial here, because the people are building a counter-narrative away from the hegemony of Fox News and CNN and MSNBC, and really even Al Jazeera. I like Al Jazeera, but the corporate response is much different from people who are in the streets. And if you look on Facebook, if you look on social media, people are showing both the peaceful demonstrations, people are showing the organizing that's going on. Right now, a lot of white people and white media is using the example of the black mother of six who caught her son and smacked him upside the head, and they're calling her the mother of the year.
Of course.
Because it's that old canard. It's back to the Moynihan Report, where it's the family, stupid. It's not these structures. And one of the things that Michelle Alexander shows us, but really the activism of Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer Stokely had taught us too, and SNCC, is that it was always about these institutions. Certainly people are very important to challenge these institutions, but the reason why Freddie Gray has a criminal record, Walter Scott's behind on child support, is because it's not individual choices when you have so many people caught up in that net of not just racial profiling, but harassment and surveillance. So they're calling her Mother of the Year because they're saying all these people just need good moms and a family. A family is important, but the big issue here is the massive both lack of resources. And one thing we don't talk about, Eric, is that the racial and economic gender exploitation, that's only a part of it, because even if you end mass incarceration, you provide rehabilitation and access, that's still not going to be black citizenship or liberation. So we are so far behind now, it's the young people who are causing all that kind of violence. And even though I don't agree with the violence, you have to have the historical context to understand why they're resorting to violence. Because the people who aren't going to resort to violence have some kind of in to these normative institutions in society. So by the time you're resorting to violence, you're not seeing a way in. And the reason you're not seeing the way in en masse, when you look at the terrible numbers in terms of social economic indicators, lack of access to health care, just good food, nutrition, education, racial segregation in residences and public schools. I mean, this is a catastrophe. Black income is 60% of white income. Black wealth is 5% of white wealth. And so you've got this economic exploitation that's happening that doesn't even allow for citizenship. So you would need two-pronged things. The president would have to sign that executive order where we do a complete overhaul of the DOJ Byrne Criminal Justice Grant, which is the largest criminal justice grant, which incentivizes anti-terrorist, anti-drug task forces to round up young black and brown men and women. You'd have to end that, but then you'd have to have a WPA New Deal-style Works Progress Administration. You'd have to have a massive trillion-dollar public works program that includes, just like the New Deal, a federal artist project, a theaters project, a mural project. You'd have to let young people who are doing music and art and hip-hop get money and have jobs. And you'd have to have playgrounds and parks in places that no one wants to put playgrounds and parks. So this is a national crisis, and the interesting part here is that until the Black Lives Matter movement sprung up, the only people who were talking about it were long marchers like you, were people who do the work I'm doing, people who do the work supporting Mumia, people doing all this political prisoner work, environmental activism, all these different works that tie together. But now there's this massive national spotlight, and people can see how massive these lies are, because people talk about racial progress, and you talk about Obama, and again, they'll commemorate Selma, and look what's happening. And in 4 months, it's going to be the commemoration of the Voting Rights Act, but they're not going to want to talk about Watts in 1965.
Well,
and
one
this
of the,
is happening all over again.
Well, one of the good things, and I appreciate that, I mean, in terms of the great work of Black Lives Matter, Patrice Cullors worked at the Strategy Center for over 10 years. And Alicia Garza, who is the executive director, was the executive director of Power.
We just had her here at Tufts.
Right. Well, she's great, and then she's now working with, of course, domestic workers organizing. So, and then we have all the people like Channing Martinez and Ron Collins and Barbara Lott Holland and Shepard Pettit and Beverly Taylor and just all the. It's happening, is what I'm saying. There is a lot of work being done in the high schools. There's being work done on the buses, and the consciousness is changing. This master narrative is being challenged by both a whole new group of younger people, but also this multi-generational movement that is going door to door on this stuff, you know. So I think one of the things that's really important right now is the reconstruction of the organizing tradition, which really has been lost. There's been a lot of focus on social media. There's been a lot of focus on even demonstrations, but the kind of deep, hard work like Ashley Franklin at the Strategy Center is doing of going to Augustus Hawkins High School every day, working with young people, building these take action clubs. I mean, this is some of the very exciting things. Laura Aguilar, Michael Davis, they are real people with real names. And one thing I want to just refer to in your book about Stokely, and I think its relevance of why I think of many reasons to read it, is I think you did a great job of showing the evolution of a person's consciousness and how rapidly during that period consciousness was changing. So Stokely going, I believe, from Howard and then going to Mississippi, and how quickly people both moved through the Democratic Party, moved to the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, moved to the Black Panthers. But one thing I wanted to ask you about is that, in my view, many of those ideas were more coexistent than people understood. It wasn't like we either hated the Democratic Party, which we did, or not work with it, because we worked in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. You know, we also worked with the Lowndes County Freedom Organization. There was tremendous internationalism. There was nonviolence and armed self-defense going on at the same time. So give me some sense of the questions of sort of intellectual ferment and how they could be relevant today in terms of a new generation.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that one of the things we tend to do is dichotomize and polarize, and we say civil rights, black power, you know, Pan-Africanism versus socialism, Marxism versus liberalism. And people coexisted and had, you know, they straddled multiple lines. So you could have black women who were black power activists, feminists, socialists, lesbian activists, you know, and you had that with the Combahee River Collective.
Exactly.
So I think you're having that right now with, you know, you've got clergy and religious leaders, you've got some young people, including, you know, BGF and different gangs who've organized for peace and not violence. So even though there's some, you could say, the police can say, well, there's some gang members who wanted to do destruction, there's going to be other members of gangs in Baltimore and around the country who've been very, very proactive for peaceful measures. And community and political control. You are going to have people who are Marxists and socialists and communists and syndicalists and others out there. You have nationalists and Pan-Africanists, feminists, civil rights activists. So it's a broad coalition. You've got white people out there, Latinos, Asian Americans. So it's a broad coalition. I think what's interesting, Eric.
You got one more minute, but no, go ahead.
Okay, which is the way young people, especially young people born after the Rodney King riots, uprising of April 29th, 1992. And one thing we're not saying is that this happened on the 27th. So it happened really 23 years, to almost to the day of Rodney King. So there's young people who are seeing this all unfold and their consciousness has been raised, including millions of young African American, white, multiracial kids who didn't realize what the stories of the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, anti-apartheid, Eleanor Bumpers, they didn't realize what all that was, and they're seeing it play out. So it's very, very important, and it's very hopeful. I mean, I think it's very hopeful because you need a new generation of people who are not going to be burdened by the past but need to look toward the past to understand it and be creatively disruptive for the future.
Great talk with you, Pinnell. And I'll tell you one last thing that I've been trying to, of my greatest contributions, is to tell folks, be careful and enjoy the political differences. We desperately need each other. We can have these debates, folks. We don't need to draw lines of demarcation that hard with each other. These are very fluid categories. Let's all work together for black liberation. You know, as you said, feminism, socialism, communism, we're all on the same side. And we got to understand that there's another side that would like to put us all in jail. So with that, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. And Pinnell, it's great to have you, and we'll keep talking.
Oh, definitely. The struggle continues, definitely.
Take good care of yourself.
Take care.
So this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, kpfk.org. I'm so glad we have Pacifica Radio. I mean it. I'm glad we have KPFK. I don't think you understand how important it is. Thank you for how great you participate, by the way, in our fun drives. And we really do love you about how much you care about us. So it makes me wake up in the morning, want to go out and struggle. I want to thank Buzz, who used to be known a.k.a. Mansoor, but he's still around. I want to thank Alan Minsky, the program director, and I want to thank all of you. Take good care of yourselves. It may be old, but it's still true. All power to the people. This is Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontlines. See you next Tuesday.